This morning in 1 Peter, we looked at a new aspect, kind of the beginning of a new section of 1 Peter, a new aspect of living as sojourners and aliens, and that is relating to this world, relating to those who are around us, specifically keeping our conduct among the Gentiles, among the non-Christian world honorable, so that when they speak against us as evildoers, they may see our good deeds and glorify God on the day of visitation. Now, what happens is Peter continues applying that in a more specific way. And that more specific way is, how do you deal with authority? How do you think of and respond to and exercise authority? And he does that. This is, in some sense, a more specific application, but it is also very general, because this section right here that we're going to look at, these verses, are a general themselves. They're a general introduction to the issues of authority that will then be the topic for the next few sections, where he'll talk about individual types of authority and submission relationships. So let's look now at 1 Peter chapter 2, 13 through 17. Be subject for the Lord's sake to every human institution, whether it be to the emperor as supreme or to governors or as sent by him, to punish those who do evil and to praise those who do good. For this is the will of God, that by doing good you should put to silence the ignorance of foolish people. Live as people who are free, not using your freedom as a cover-up for evil, but living as servants of God. Honor everyone. Love the brotherhood, fear God, honor the emperor. Be subject for the Lord's sake to every human institution. Now this phrase, you may see, I don't know if your pew Bibles or certainly your bulletin doesn't have this footnote, but my ESV has this footnote. This is one of the weaknesses of, I guess I could have put the footnote in there. The footnote in the ESV says this. If you're not looking at it, I'll tell you. The footnote at every human institution says, or every institution ordained for people. The reason that it says that is the word here for human institution is a word that is, every other place is used to describe the creation. God's creation of the world. And so the implication is, be subject to every system of authority that God has created into this world, that God has ordained for humanity, that God, as the author of all authority, has ordained, has planned that there would be certain structures in society, and you are to be subject to them. So what I'd like to do tonight, because this is a section that is the beginning of a whole section on submitting to authority, I'd like to do a little bit of thinking with you about authority. What is it? How do we think about it rightly? How does it fit in? So in doing this, I'm just, out of full disclosure, I'm very much enjoying and relying to some extent on this book, Jonathan Lehman, Authority. Jonathan Lehman is one of the writers for Nine Marks Ministry, which is the education and publishing ministry associated with Capitol Hill Baptist Church, where Pastor Mark Dever is. I don't know how many of you are familiar with that situation. It's very good church. He has some wonderful biblical theology in here, and wonderful observations that are very seminal in my mind, which means he makes observations that encourage me to think in all new and exciting areas, all driven by a biblical study of authority. So I'm going to have some thoughts that are reliant on him. So what I want to do is think about This idea that I introduced to you from the text, that God created authority into the structure of the world. And we start by thinking about that, thinking about God as the author of authority. God is the author of authority. How does God, as the supreme authority, exercise authority? So that's the first thing. He is the supreme authority. He is the ruler over everything. There is nothing anywhere that exists that is not under his rule. Every atom, everything is under his rule. God creates the world, right? And then God makes humans, and in doing so, God exercises his authority. He places the humans under his authority, and he places the humans in authority, gives them authority. So what can we say? We can say God's exercise of authority in creating the world is generous and life-giving. It's generous and life-giving. He has the power, and he used that power to create this world and to create us and to give it to us. Secondly, his authority specifically over the people, meaning when he created them, he had the right to tell them what to do and what not to do. That authority and his exercise of it was good and a blessing. When God told them what to do and what not to do, when he gave them a sense of right and wrong, it was not to harm them. It was to help them fully enjoy all that he had created. His authority was a blessing to them. It was meant to increase their life and enable them to live fully and expand. He also uses his authority to make lavish provision for them. He used his authority to give them whatever they needed to do this. Adam needed a helper. He gave a helper. They needed food. He gave them abundant food. You may eat of everything that's in the garden except for this one tree. He gave them all that they needed, the intelligence to name the animals, to make things, to design things, everything that was necessary for the job he was giving them, he gave them. His authority made lavish provision. And then, amazingly, this is profound, he shares his authority. He shares his authority. He delegates, in a sense, his authority. He says to the humans, you have dominion over the whole earth. Now, God was the boss. God had dominion over the whole earth, and God still does. And yet God said to the humans, I am giving you authority over the whole earth. And then you know what? He didn't micromanage. He wasn't going to micromanage. He was going to say, you do it. And where do we see the first example of that? He brought the animals to Adam. He had the authority to be the zookeeper and the zoologist and name these animals. And God didn't say, oh, no, horse? No. That's a bad one. I want you to stop again. Try a new one. Cow? No. Try again. He let Adam exercise his authority. So God's use of authority was generous, life-giving. It was a blessing. It was lavish in its provision. And it was generous in its sharing of his own authority. So Jonathan Lehman makes some observations then on the basis of the way God exercises authority. He names four purposes of authority, the way God created it. So I want to briefly give some of these. Some of these will be directly applicable to the rest of the verses in this passage, and some of them will be things we will come back to later when we're in 1 Peter. So the first one is the purpose of authority is to give life and growth to those under authority. God's intent in giving a structure and instructions to humanity was to see humanity grow and expand and fully blossom and bear fruit. In order for them to do that, they had to obey him. He knew best how to set this up. And the purpose of his exercising authority was to help them to do that. And he also, in doing that, that's why he made the provision. That's why he gave them all that they needed. I had a boss when I was working at Westminster. I had a boss who, to me, exemplified this. He had very high standards for those of us who worked for him at the Westminster Bookstore. Very high standards about how we would pick books for orders, the accuracy of those books, how we would do that, which books we would reject and which ones we would take. There were very high standards. But he also, not only did he do that because he knew that's what it would take for us to thrive as bookstore employees and as a bookstore, but he made sure that whatever we needed to fulfill those instructions, he would give. He was famous for saying, if there was any kind of a problem, is there anything that I can provide for you to help you solve that problem? What do we need? Whatever we need, let's get it. He was intent on making working for him a blessing. He did things like for the break room, he used the American Express points that he used to buy items for the bookstore. He used the points that he racked up to buy stuff to make the office a better place to be. So we didn't just have coffee in our coffee room at Westminster Bookstore. We had a Nespresso machine with a milk frother and an abundant supply of wonderful espresso packets. Now, you know, if you have an espresso machine, if you've ever tasted an espresso compared to Keurig, it's like Mercedes compared to Chevy. So this was provision. This was generous. This was life-giving and expansive. That's God's purpose for authority. Secondly, it's to give life and growth to those exercising authority. So the first one is to give life and growth to those under authority. But it's also his purpose to give life and growth to those exercising authority. You think about this. God's plan for Adam and Eve, for people, was not just static. It was to grow. As they exercised their authority, bearing dominion over the earth, that authority and that dominion would grow, and the glory of the Lord through them would fill the whole earth. You see this principle when Jesus tells a parable of various workers and says, you have been faithful in little, you now will be given authority over much. The idea, this is the way God thinks of authority. When he gives you authority, his intent is that in your use of that authority, you would learn more, you would be trained to be more like him in his use of authority, and in becoming more like him, he would then be able to give you more authority and expand. So just as for those under authority, it's expansive and allowing them to grow, so also for those in authority, it's expansive and allowing them to grow. Again, my boss at the bookstore, he didn't just give us all we needed to obey him to be good employees. He gave us authority. He made us responsible for things. There was a point where he gave me the authority over shipping and receiving. And he said to me, this is your area. You know my standards. Whatever you need, I'll get you, but you design a way for this to happen according to our standards of excellence. And then his goal was that if I started to do that and did that well, he was priming me then to move up to be something else. He was hoping, and he even did at some point, gave to a few of us the title director, and maybe premature, we kind of saw through that and thought, we're not directors yet. But he was expressing, this is my goal for you. I don't want this to be static. I want this to be an expansive, growing thing. One note here. Everyone is in both of those first two categories. Everyone, except for perhaps infants and toddlers, is both under authority and in authority. Every one of us has some area that God expects us to exercise our will and decision-making capability to glorify him in. And that is a giving of authority. And as we grow, his intent is that we would expand and grow in that and thrive and blossom, both as those who submit to him and to others, and as those who have authority over others. The two other purposes, the third one is one we won't go further, but I just want to mention it, is to create groups and give them an assignment. This is very practical. Think about it. You can't have a company without authority. You can't have, you know, just a group of people and say, this is a company, if there's nobody who is deciding what the group is going to do next. It's just absolutely necessary. And what is useful about this, and we'll bring this in when we look at some of the other relationships, is he creates groups through authority and gives them assignment. And the authority is controlled or limited by that assignment. This introduces the idea of jurisdiction or purpose. So, for instance, when Jonathan Lehman is talking about exceptions to submission, you know, we all know that the easy one is, well, when authority asks you to disobey God. Well, another exception to submission is when the authority is trying to ask you to do something which is sort of outside their jurisdiction, outside their lane, not according to the purpose of what their authority is given for. So, for instance, the example he gives is this: a police officer pulls him over, he rolls down the window, and the police officer whose son goes to school with Jonathan Lehman's daughter says, "I command you to let your son marry my daughter." And Jonathan Lehman says, "Excuse me?" Whereas if he had said, "Show me your driver's license and registration," Jonathan Lehman would have said, "Yes, sir." So there's a difference. What if the governor of Pennsylvania called me this afternoon and said, "Hi, Jim Widener, I am the governor of Pennsylvania. I want you to sing Amazing Grace tonight at church, and not the hymns that you've picked." It would not be a sin to sing Amazing Grace. And yet, I would be able to say to the governor, "Governor, I appreciate the suggestion, but it's not your call. It's not your call." So that's a valid and fascinating principle, jurisdiction. The fourth purpose of authority is to teach and show what God is like. We are image bearers, right? And part of bearing his image is bearing his authority. That's why, as image bearers, he shares his authority and gives it to us. When we have dominion over the earth, we're acting in the image of God over the earth. Again, as this morning, this glorifies God, and the glory of God is the final aim of all this. There's the inner workings, the specifics, and then there's the glory of God, and that is the final aim. Now, how do we apply this in a fallen world? See, here's the issue. There's created authority, and then there's fallen authority, because we fell into sin. And we know in this world, authority is almost a bad word. It's almost like if a four-letter word could have 11, 12, however many letters it has. Authority. We fear authority. We have sayings like absolute authority corrupts absolutely. We live in this world of fallen authority where we don't submit well and we don't exercise authority well. And then there's redeemed authority. And redeemed authority comes about because God, as the ultimate authority, uses his authority to win back and buy back those who have rebelled against his authority. He, as the authority, takes on the cost, the burden, the injury, so to speak, of that rebellion himself, and so buys back those who are rebelling and brings them back into his authority. We now, as those who know that, who have been redeemed, we are to live not in a perfect world, not in the world that Adam and Eve lived in terms of Everything is the way it's created to be right now. We must now live and strive towards God's standard of authority and submission in the context of this world is broken and authority doesn't make any sense or doesn't make sense to our world. So we're going to look now briefly at verse 15, 16, and 17. And each one of those I'm going to ask, how does that verse fill out this experience? Verse 15, "For this is the will of God, that by doing good, you should put to silence the ignorance of foolish people." So I would describe this as God intends that we would be agents of conviction in the presence of a world full of fallen authority. Remember, this morning we heard that through our good behavior, God intends to bring some to glorify him, to praise him. This is saying God intends our behavior to be the witness that gives people no excuse. So there's a difference between people glorifying him and people being silenced. Being silenced is you are saying wrong things, but then you're going to see this and it's going to zip your lips. It's going to say, I have nothing to say. So our living out redeemed authority, as we live authority and submission in such a way that shows God's character in our relationships, what do? We show the world what it should be. And in so doing, we convict the world of its faulty view of authority. It's a little bit like in Romans 1, we hear that people are without excuse because they see creation. They're without excuse because creation witnesses to the power, the eternity and the power of God. Well, humans who speak of creation and praise God for creation also amplify that conviction. So if you go to the Creation Museum, for instance, possibly in Kentucky, any place that amplifies the fact that God, the truth that God created this world, is then amplifying that conviction. And so it is true that God's authority is indisputable and is perceivable to anyone who sees it. And yet, when they see Christians acting in a way that displays God's authority the way it was intended, it is supposed to bring conviction to them. This moves us to verse 16. Verse 16, "Live as people who are free, not using your freedom as a cover-up for evil, but living as servants of God." So what does it mean to live as free? It means, I think, living as people who understand the delegated and provisional character of whatever authority is over us, and we know that it is all ultimately under God, and we know God as our personal Savior and our friend, in the sense that the Apostle John talks about God as our friend. In other words, we have an intimate and restored relationship to the master of the whole universe, and yet we are in relationships of authority and submission to those who don't know him. So let me try to illustrate this with a hypothetical situation. Imagine that you are the son of the owner of a company. And your father, the owner of the company, has asked you for a time to work in a work group as the leader of a small work group down in the lower parts of the hierarchy of the company. So you have a boss, middle management boss, who's not related to you and not your father. It's just some dude or some gal. And you have people under you. You know that your dad is the owner. In fact, you know that someday you're going to inherit the company and you will be the owner. And yet you willingly are underneath the authority of this middle manager. And you willingly take the lowly role of simply leading this work group. Even if the manager that you are under makes decisions that you're pretty confident you could do better at. You're pretty confident that your dad wouldn't do it that way. but you're under him. You are free, you are the son of the owner, but you're going to willingly follow this middle manager. Even if that manager resents you, makes your life a bit miserable, and does that simply because he knows that you are a person of privilege and that your father is the owner. Now you can easily see also how a son, how the person in this scenario might take advantage of this. In other words, as it says in the scriptures here, as Peter says, using freedom as a cover-up for evil. Because you know the temptations you would have if you were that son in that position. The son may be tempted to bend the rules. Why do I have to keep the rules? This is basically my company. Don't I make the rules? Maybe the son thinks, well, I'm going to start taking snacks from the snack room, and I'm just going to take them home, save a little bit on my grocery bill. I'm just taking them, because after all, it's my dad's company. I own the snacks. Or the son may be tempted to get an attitude toward his boss and his peers. He may begin to resent him and disdain him. After all, he knows better than him. He knows the father. He knows the owner. He knows better than the middle manager, who apparently does not share his father's vision for the company. This would make him less willing to follow and obey. Now let's take this little hypothetical and let's bring it into the church, into the scenario that Peter was talking about. How might this look? One scenario is Christians getting the attitude that because we will inherit the earth, and because God intends for us to rule over the whole earth and has promised that we can do whatever we want in the here and now. After all, it's my Father's world. He rules over all, and I'm ruling with him. So why do I have to follow the world's authority? I suppose there are Christians in history who have taken this view, have done something like this. Groups that maybe say, we don't have to pay taxes because we're above this. I mean, this does happen. But I think more likely is the second example. And that is the temptation to see our Christian community as so superior and separate from the rest of the world in terms of its use of authority that we live in a radically us versus them mentality. And we begin to be resentful, increasingly resentful and grumpy about their authority over us. We are disdainful of our peers, wanting only to find a safe haven where we can retreat and be holy without being bothered by other people. See, Peter's vision is not that we would be a kind of a microcosm of redeemed authority and submission and just ignore and avoid all of the world's perversions of it. Peter's vision is that we would be constantly in and amongst the unchristian world as a constant example to them of what fearing God and loving and trusting God looks like in regard to authority and submission. We're to be an active example of God's loving authority by the way we submit to human authority, and we are to make palatable to them God's authority by making the way we exercise authority beautiful. That it is not to take and to own and to diminish, but to give and to expand and to give life and blessing. So that brings us then to verse 17. What do we see here? Honor everyone, love the brotherhood, fear God, honor the emperor. Now, there's two tiers here, if you look at it closely. There's two tiers of loyalty and submission in this verse. There's a joyful, intimate tier. Love the brotherhood. Fear God. And there's a honorable, respectful tier. Honor everyone. Honor the emperor. Peter's presenting a vision for how we, as free submitters to God, can both enjoy the goodness of his authority as God created it and bless the world by acting out that authority in their view and whenever possible toward them. First, God intends for us to enjoy this privilege and joy in the context of church relationships. So this intimate tier, fearing God and loving the brotherhood. Peter brings it, he keeps bringing it back to loving relationships in the church. The son in the company, in our hypothetical. Let's say he has some siblings in a similar situation. These siblings work in different parts of the company. Well, he relates to everyone in the company, those above him, his boss, in a respectful, honorable way, out of respect for his father and because he loves his father and trusts his father. He relates to those under him by exercising authority in a way that reflects his father's values. These are honorable relationships. But he goes home and he eats dinner with his brothers and sisters. He shares a home with them. There's a higher level of freedom and joy and intimacy with them. And that is us in the church. We live in the world. We do our Father's bidding willingly as free people in the world. And yet, honoring the emperor, honoring those who are over us and under us, we fear God and love the brotherhood. It's a higher level of intimacy and enjoyment. But then there's that other level, not the intimate level, but the other level. And in that, we display God-like authority to them, not just as a source of conviction, but also as a showcase to the world of what God is like. So again, the son in that company, he has great opportunity to shape the culture, to help his father, the owner, shape the culture of that company. How does he do that? He understands, more than anyone else around him, he understands the mind of the owner. He understands the vision of the owner. He knows where his dad wants to bring that company. He knows, he shares that vision, unlike everyone around him. And he knows that part of that vision is for how people will relate to each other and how authority works in that company. And so he can be a picture to those above him and those below him. To those above him, he displays the type of honorable, helpful, cooperative submission that he knows God calls for and God blesses. His father calls for and blesses. To those under him, he wants to display the kind of gracious, loving, generous, vision-filled, expansive authority that he knows his dad wants the company culture to have. In his position, he can do all of that if he submits to his father and, as a free person, submits to his middle manager who doesn't really know his father very well. So what does this have to do with the gospel? Remember, in this situation, God's authority is redemptive. We're showing God's authority, and it's redemptive. God, in exercising his authority, again, took the cost of the disobedience, the cost of the lack of submission. He took on himself. It cost him. It hurt him. It was sacrificial for him to redeem those who were rebels from the authority. And if we live this way, if we live like this son in this hypothetical company, if we live serving God and his vision for the world, obeying those who are over us, even when it's not exactly the way we know it should be, when they are not generous and they're not kind and they're not seeking to make provision and they're not seeking to bless us and expand us, when we take that cost on us, we display the gospel to them. And to those that are under us, when they don't obey, when they don't do what we're told, when they don't have a good attitude, when they don't share the vision, when they don't believe us when we talk to them, etc., 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 we display the redemptive glory of God's authority when we take some of that cost on us. And we offer them in some way, we offer them grace and an opportunity for reconciliation. So we who know the gospel then are called in the midst of authority structures to display that gospel. That is, in a nutshell, that's your introduction to some of the specifics that Peter is going to get into now in the rest of the book. So let me pray, and then I'll tell you what we're going to do next. Lord, thank you for the incredibly gracious way that you, who are the King of the universe, relate to us, not only calling us to willfully submit to you, but giving us authority that is so incredibly exciting. Help us to learn how to live out a picture of that in this world which knows nothing but bad authority. In Jesus' name, amen.